Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the impassioned plea by the father of the journalist who was murdered on camera, along with her cameraman, to our gutless politicians, calling them out that it is time for them to stand up to the NRA. Ladd Everett, Director of Communications at the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, joins us to discuss the sickening pattern in America where mass shootings take place in cinemas, churches, and now live on TV. Then the majority of the population share the nation's and the world's outrage and demand something be done to keep guns out of the hands of the mentally ill. Then the NRA steps in and cows enough politicians to do nothing so that the gun lobby can continue ensuring that America's criminals are the best armed in the world and that any loner, loser, misfit, or mentally disturbed person in America can buy an arsenal and murder as many of their fellow citizens as possible. Then, since the recent upheavals on the global stock markets were related to China's economy, we will examine the Chinese fiscal, banking, and political situation in depth with Min-Hsin Pei, a professor of government and director of the Keck Center for International Strategic Studies at Claremont McKenna College. We will discuss the problems posed by debt bubbles not yet burst and the endemic corruption, as well as assess the leadership's vain efforts to revive communist ideology and its more aggressive nationalism that seems to have backfired. Then finally, we will speak with Florida Congressman Alan Grayson, who is running for Marco Rubio's vacated U.S. Senate seat as an economic populist against a former Republican in the Democratic primary. We will discuss the peculiar politics of the important electoral state of Florida, where a criminal who paid a record fine for bilking millions of elderly folk was elected twice as governor in a state dominated by retirees, as well as assess the electoral chances of the two Floridians running for president, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. Joining us now is Ladd Everett, Director of Communications at the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He previously served as a volunteer with the D.C. Crisis Response Team, a group which offered comfort, support, and referred services to victims and survivors of homicide in the District of Columbia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ladd Everett.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And the fact that the father of the TV reporter that was shot on camera has gone public and castigated lawmakers in Washington, D.C. for being gutless and not standing up against the NRA. I recall that that also happened after the Santa Barbara shooting as well. So do you think that this time it will make a difference that the father of a victim could be actually listened to?
Well, I think every time a survivor like this steps forward and becomes involved in the movement and works for change, it makes a difference. You referred there to Richard Martinez, who lost his son at Isla Vista, and he's made a tremendous difference with his advocacy. So, yeah, I certainly think it will make a difference. Also, you know, there's important work to be done, not only at the federal level, but certainly also at the state level in Virginia. And I think this gentleman is going to have a significant impact there on debates about gun policy.
Well, the governor of Virginia has already made it pretty clear that he wants to deal with this situation, which the federal government has been unable to deal with. I recall that after Sandy Hook, President Obama, against the advice of Democratic Party officials who thought that gun control was a losing issue politically, he nevertheless stepped up. And he actually got a bill passed, but then because of the peculiar nature of the Senate requiring a supermajority, he was, a couple of votes short. So is that going to be revived at the state level, or do you think it's just dead at the federal level?
Well, I do think you'll see a vote on background checks again, expanding background checks in Congress. When exactly that happens, I don't know. It could be something that we see happen after the upcoming election in 2016, but I think it'll be back. And we have seen forward progress in enacting universal background check policies at the state level since 2013. The most recent examples would be Oregon and Washington. The state of Washington enacted universal background checks by ballot referendum, Oregon by legislature and governor. So we're seeing forward progress on that. And then coming up in 2016, it will be on the ballot in Nevada, which will likely be a huge victory. So, you know, that continues to march forward. I think those of us in the gun violence prevention movement understand that we need really to be pushing on all levels here, federal, state level, and certainly also in our courts.
So, but we seem as a country, and we're pretty unique in the world in this, to be locked in a cycle where it takes some hideous massacre of people, whether it's in a cinema or in a church, or in this case, just on the job, live on television, to be gunned down. And then the nation acts with horror and abhorrence. And then a few politicians step up, but eventually the NRA, because they seem so well organized, manage to either scare the majority off or undermine the efforts that are being made. And then we go back to the status quo ante. So do you recognize this cycle that we're in? That, in other words, what's it going to take? A massacre of 1,000 people instead of, 20-something innocent little school kids?
Well, I think that's the wrong way to look at it. And I think you actually touched on what is going to make a difference, which is what the NRA started doing 40 years ago, which is simple capacity building. The NRA does two things particularly well that we've been doing, the gun violence prevention movement, that is, a heck of a lot better since Newtown. One is, plain old grassroots organizing, having that core of supporters that is constantly messaging to legislators. And our movement has made tremendous gains in that area since Newtown. There's completely new national grassroots organizations on the ground right now on our side. The obvious example would be Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, which has chapters in all 50 states and people active on the ground on a daily basis. But it goes beyond that, too. There's progressive organizations like Organizing for America that paid lip service to this issue in the past, but now are actively working it. So that picture has been transformed totally. And then the other way that the NRA, of course, has built capacity and had a huge impact on politicians is by spending money in election cycles. And they had that, up until 2012, they had that field really to themselves. And that made a huge difference, obviously. But in 2012, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who runs Every Town for Gun Safety, stood up his Independence USA PAC, which is weighing in heavily on the gun issue on our side now. And then also, obviously, after the Tucson shooting, Gabby Giffords and Mark Kelly stood up Americans for Responsible Solutions, which has a PAC which has raised, again, millions upon millions of dollars and is going to be heavily involved in the 2016 election. So, I think it's a flawed way to see this as, if everything in the world has not changed after a single shooting, we failed. I think looking at it that way for so long doomed us to failure. I think what we needed to be doing all along is what we've made huge strides in since Newtown, which is building capacity for the long term, not for any given shooting, because this is not any different than the civil rights struggle. The civil rights struggle saw one horror after the next, and it wasn't necessarily one or the other. It was the accumulation of those that led to good ground organizing, messaging, and the things that it took to move the ball forward. And I think we're doing those same things now.
So when the father of Allison Parker, the journalist who was shot live on television, along with her cameraman, he went public on a number of TV outlets today. But he challenged the president, President Obama, who I think is someone that's pretty clearly tried to do the best he could. He said, "You did it with health care reform, which nobody said you could do. You did it with an Iran deal that everybody said you couldn't do. These are people's lives right here in the country." So I know the president, I don't know him, but from watching him, I know he's a compassionate man, and I'm sure that got to him. What can he do?
Well, the answer, is his powers are limited, obviously. We have a separation of powers under our Constitution, and we don't have a president that can do it all. That might be a fact that's frustrating to some, but, it's good government. It's the separation is there for a reason. That said, I think the president does have the ability to do something here. And he's stated that he will be looking at potential additional executive actions on this issue. Of course, after Newtown, he issued something along the lines of 25 executive orders to improve U.S. gun laws. I think he recently commented that he's no longer worried how Republicans are going to respond to these types of orders, and he's going to actively look at ways that he can help the nation. But, you know, there's only so much he can do. When he passed the health care law, of course, he had a Democratic Congress in place there for a little bit. Now he has, you know, Republicans in control of both chambers. He can't do it all. You know, he can use the bully pulpit and put pressure on them. But really, you know, I think the president was right when he said this is not going to change until, and he looked at the camera and he said, you, meaning American citizens, stand up and tell your legislators you've had enough. And he's right. He can't do it all. It has to come from average Americans that are feeling physically sick right now, and who get on the phone, who get on their computer and email, who show up at town hall meetings and put pressure on their legislators. There is no other way. But the good news is that if you're willing to work hard and engage democratically, the NRA has proved that that model works beautifully.
Well, clearly there's more upset, revolted, angry, disgusted people in this country than there are members of the NRA.
Oh, absolutely. And the key is to mobilize and motivate them to the point where if you haven't quite made them a single issue voter on this, which would be the ideal, then at least you're getting them to regularly message legislators. Legislators in this country, I think we all know now, are not a principled lot. But the good news is that they, as you know, the cowardly ones do respond to pressure. They respond to political pressure, and they seek to move in a direction where that pressure is not. So again, if we can be the ones who are getting louder than the pro-gun side and consistently in the faces of our legislators telling them, listen, you know, if you don't immediately take action to strengthen our gun laws, I will do everything I can democratically and peacefully to end your political career, to, you know, make sure you get another job somewhere that you might be better at. That's what we have to do. It's the simple work of being constantly in their faces. Another good thing is to call their donors. If you know the donors of politicians in your community who are voting with the NRA on this and putting our families in the line of fire, call up those donors. There's no substitute for the good old-fashioned hard work of democratic engagement. There's no magic wand here. The magic wand is a return to the basics, which the NRA have gotten right for a long time. And it's time to take a page from their book and out-organize them and also get louder than them. Their core is a very loud and persistent lot, and we need to be louder than they are.
Well, Lad Everett, though, obviously it's an election year, at least next year is, but it's already happening. The presidential primaries are underway. Surely this, then, what you're telling us, this is the perfect time, isn't it? I mean, I was astounded by the Republican, he's not the front runner, but he was touted as the front runner, Jeb Bush. Yesterday, after the shooting had taken place, he was simply asked for his comments on it, and he simply couldn't say anything. He said, I haven't really looked into it enough. You know, I don't really know. Obviously, it's a tragedy. I mean, it's just that beyond embarrassing. Now, in terms of the Republican presidential hopeful so far, only Jim Gilmore and Ben Carson have spoken up, and they've warned against any rush to introduce tougher gun control. So, where are the politicians, apart from Governor McAuliffe of Virginia, where are the politicians screaming from the rafters in opposition to the kind of stuff that Ben Carson is putting out and the lack of statements coming from Jeb Bush?
Well, certainly on the Democratic side, I mean, Hillary Clinton has been speaking about this issue constantly on the stump. Which tells me that her team now believes, and you referred to this before, that they believe now that the issue of gun violence prevention is good politics for them. I don't think Hillary would be talking about it if she didn't believe that. Also, Martin O'Malley, running for president on the Democratic side, has been incredibly outspoken about this. He posted the other day on Facebook an NRA magazine cover that had him on there and bragged about it, that they were attacking him. Bernie Sanders has been more of a mixed bag there. He's made some very strong statements about renewing the assault weapons ban and supporting certain other gun violence prevention laws. But he's also faced some very tough questions about certain pro-gun votes he's taken. But I think, you know, again, on the Democratic side, I'm seeing a lot of attention to this issue that I did not see in past election cycles. On the Republican side, I think that's a factor of the dynamics of Republican primary politics right now. Those politics are extreme right wing. The guys running to get that nomination essentially have to be in bed, not only with the gun lobby, but basically every other corporate lobby in America. I don't think there's anything unique whatsoever about the gun issue in this circumstance, but it's kind of to be expected. I think the question is, whoever emerges from the GOP side, what does that look like then when we get to, a general presidential debate with a Democratic candidate? And I think the Republican candidate's going to have to face a lot of tough questions on this.
Well, just in closing, you mentioned corporate lobbies. Isn't the NRA a corporate lobby? Don't they get their money from gun manufacturers and ammunition manufacturers?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's important to understand a couple of things here. Number one, the NRA has gun industry executives that are sitting directly on their board of directors, guys like Ronnie Barrett and Pete Brownell and Steve Hornady and others. The other thing is that they have what they call their Ring of Freedom program, through which they get tens of millions of dollars in direct corporate contributions from gun companies on an annual basis. And that's just the high-level support. There's a whole other system of kind of symbiotic relationships between the NRA and the gun industry, down to the smallest level of things like when you join a gun club in your community, being required to join the NRA before you join that gun club. So, it's a very symbiotic relationship. And to put it simply, the NRA financially does better when the gun industry is selling more guns.
Well, Ladd Everett, I appreciate your time and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ladd Everett, who's the Director of Communications at the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He previously served as a volunteer with the DC Crisis Response Team, a group which offered comfort, support, and referral services to victims and survivors of homicide in the District of Columbia. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an in-depth look into China's economy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Min-Chin Pei, a professor of government and the George R. Roberts Fellow and director of the Keck Center for International and Strategic Studies at Claremont McKenna College. He's the author of China's Trapped Transition, The Limits of Development, Autocracy, and From Reform to Revolution, The Demise of Communism in China and the Soviet Union. Welcome to Background Briefing, Min-Chin Pei.
It's a pleasure to join you.
And after these severe losses on the Chinese market over the past weeks, I believe actually since June, the losses have been something globally, something around 10 trillion, at least 3 trillion in the last week or so. Obviously, they've sent shockwaves around the world. But do you think the move by the country's central bank on Tuesday, which didn't calm the markets, is there a sense that the U.S. markets now are sort of stable? So what's your explanation for that?
Well, market participants have their own psychology, so it is very hard to explain, to give a rational explanation of essentially an irrational behavior. But let me try anyway. I think in response to your question about China's central bank's lowering of interest rates and reserve ratio and whether that's going to help, I think it helps, but not a whole lot. The problem with China today is that monetary policy is decreasingly effective. there seems to be a divorce between the financial sector and the real economy. My own interpretation is that most of the newly created credit simply has gone into paying off overdue loans. So very little money actually gets into the real economy. And on top of that, there is very little real demand. So even if you have money, you don't want to invest. You do not want to build new factories. And that is the source of China's real economic problem, not the stock market crash. Of course, the stock market crash is ugly, but it is a symptom, but not the cause.
And how do you explain that the Chinese shares have closed 5% higher after these huge losses earlier in the week with the Shanghai
Composite? Short-term market behavior, as I said, is totally irrational. You can have a very technical explanation. That normally you have, you're going to have a technical rebound once you have huge losses. I think the Chinese market lost something like 15% in three trading sessions. So a technical rebound of 5% is actually to be expected, just like the U.S.
So in terms, though, this is what I understand, that the difference is in many ways, that which indicates that we're not so well off as we think and China is not so badly off as we think. My understanding from talking to some Wall Street insiders is that the U.S. economy is actually quite fragile because the Fed has pumped all of this money, all of this liquidity into the banks and not into the real economy. And that, you know, if there's a recession, we got nowhere to go because interest rates are almost at zero. You can't go below zero. At least nobody has. Nobody knows how to do that. Whereas China's got more flexibility in terms of how they can deal. They've got more tools in their toolbox. Is that a proper perception?
No, well, I think this actually puts things upside down. The U.S. economy, first let's say that the global economy is not doing well, largely because of lack of demand. There is overcapacity, deflationary pressure all over the world, in every economy. Interest rates are low across the globe, and that is a very ominous sign. In the case of the U.S., about which I know relatively little, but I would still venture that interest rate today is actually negative. So monetary policy has lost its real effectiveness for a long, long time. But the U.S. economy is far more resilient. That is, you have a very productive labor force. You do not have huge debt borrowed by people who cannot repay. But when you look at China, debt to GDP for a country with one-fifth of U.S. per capita income is 300%, very close to the U.S. level. And there are bubbles that have not really been squeezed out. The real estate bubble, the stock market bubble has come down a great deal. That's good news. And overcapacity in practically every major industrial sector. And the interest rate in China actually is coming down very fast. Today, one-year lending rate is around 4%. So they actually do not have a lot of flexibility either. So I would not paint China as an economy with a great deal of resilience and flexibility building. I would actually use these two terms to describe the U.S. economy.
So given what you've just told us then, what would you say is in terms of this strange embrace between the U.S. and China? They're intertwined, but they're certainly not lovers. And to what extent then are we vulnerable to the Chinese economy?
We're certainly vulnerable in several ways. One is that the U.S. sells roughly 8% of its exports to China. So if China slows down, the demand for certain U.S. exports will slow down, especially automobile. And even the Boeing aircraft will have to be curtailed. The other indirect impact on the U.S. economy, which a Chinese slowdown can produce, is that China is connected with other major economies. So if China slows down, other economies slows down, and then the other economies will have less demand for American goods. So there is an indirect impact. And the third impact is China's purchase of U.S. Treasury debt. If China's economy is doing less well, it might not have enough surpluses to buy U.S. Treasury debt, which will not cause a financial crisis in the U.S., but it will have an impact on U.S. interest rates. So interest rates might go up as a result.
So in the broader sense, though, let me refer to your latest book, From Reform to Revolution, The Demise of Communism in China and the Soviet Union. Of course, one of the ironies was that Gorbachev, the great reformer, showed up in China at the very moment of Tiananmen and left. And it seems to me that the Chinese authorities, after they cracked down on Tiananmen, made the decision that they didn't want to follow Russia's idea of having perestroika, economic restructuring, stimulated by glasnost, the ability for everybody to speak out, because suddenly, as in Russia, as the people were allowed to speak freely or openly, the emperor had no clothes and the entire system collapsed. And it seems that the Chinese leaders since then have decided that they will have unlimited perestroika, but no glasnost. Is that the correct analysis?
Oh, yes, well, that indeed was the model of the Chinese political and economic development after Tiananmen for the last 25 years. And for a while, it appeared to be working. But that model has exhausted itself. Today, what we are seeing in China is the end of this, what we call new authoritarian model. That is, you have pro-market economic policy, but very repressive political system. This combination no longer works. Because what this combination does is political elites would use their political power to steal from society. And at the end of the day, you have high inequality, high corruption, and then systemic economic inefficiency. So that's actually the root of China's economic maladies today.
And well, my understanding is that corruption is such a huge factor that they've had to fire so many local officials that there are an enormous number of sort of empty desks. So how does that play into this bifurcation in China between an attempt to have government institutions, on the one hand, operating in parallel with the Communist Party itself, which is where the power is and where most of the corruption appears to be?
Well, I think the problem today is that you have a Leninist system which is unaccountable to anybody. And Lord Acton said absolute power means absolute corruption. So now you just do not have to doubt the wisdom of that observation in China. The only solution is to place political power, including that controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, under strict constitutional and legal limits. But this is a path the current regime does not want to take.
So how would you describe the current regime? Because clearly they're using corruption selectively, at least at the highest levels, going after political opponents, even though it's an attempt by Xi Jinping to sort of tap into the Chinese people's anger at inequality and corruption, etc., which is quite rampant. Russia is clearly today a kind of gangster economy run by a kind of mafia elite regulated by the new Tsar, Vladimir Putin. How would you describe China? Is it gangster capitalism or is it something more savory?
Well, if I want to be polite and sound academic, I would say China today has a decentralized crony capitalist system. Well, this means that China does not have the kind of kleptocracy you see in Russia. But China has a lot of mini, semi-kleptocrats everywhere throughout the system. That's because the Chinese economy is not resource-based. Chinese economy is manufacturing-based, and the wealth is dispersed throughout society. That does not mean that China does not have kleptocrats. It simply means China has a lot of smaller versions of Russian oligarchs.
And these oligarchs seem to be parking a lot of their money abroad and sending their children abroad to be educated. Is there a brain drain going on?
Well, there's certainly, in a technical sense, this brain drain. But the good news about China is that It has almost 1.4 billion people, and a lot of smart people there. So if they send out 1%, which will be 14 million abroad, that's not going to affect China in a real sense. And today, China sends abroad roughly 600 to a million people. So that's really a tiny, tiny share of the population. I'm not going to lose sleep over this so-called brain drain. I'm actually far more worried about China as a society not investing enough in its primary education, in its secondary education, in its own underprivileged people, because these are the people that China will rely on to build its economy in the future.
Well, my understanding is that China has made extraordinary investments in infrastructure compared to the United States, where we haven't invested a damn thing in our crumbling roads and rails, and we have all-time low interest rates. So it's because of this disgraceful political gridlock in Washington. But China has put together extraordinary high-speed rail pipelines all the way to the Indian Ocean in Pakistan, into Russia, etc. So that would seem to me something that we could emulate. But give us more details on what you think is the deficit in primary education and not helping the rural poor. I take it that's where most of the poverty is. Although there's been so much emigration to the cities, I imagine there's also a lot of urban poverty as well.
Yeah, well, China's inequality has two aspects. One is intra-regional, that's within the same area you have higher income and low income. And the other is rural versus urban. And that ratio has always been 1 to 4. That is, rural income is only 25% of urban income. This is very high inequality. And that is also reflected in human capital investment, education, and healthcare. A rural kid in China gets roughly 9 years of education, and that does not account for quality, while an urban child gets 12 years. So if I were the Chinese government, I would not try to waste money to build China's versions of Harvard, Yale, Princeton. I would actually try to put all my money in villages, in rural areas where children can actually get 12 years of schooling rather than 9 years.
So turning to politics here in the United States, you know, in terms of the presidential candidates running on the Republican side, in terms of their foreign policy and their attitudes to China, you've got Donald Trump just being ridiculous and making outrageous and insulting comments about China. And then amongst a few of the others, most of their foreign policy about China is guided by the neoconservatives who brought us the Iraq War and want to sell China as this huge military menace in the Pacific. My understanding is that the Chinese leadership have so much on their plate that they're not interested in foreign adventures. They're simply interested in riding the tiger.
Well, this is no longer true. Unfortunately, I would have to say that certain things the Chinese government has done, for example, in the South China Sea, in East China Sea, are not the things their predecessors, people like Deng Xiaoping would condone. Because they've violated Deng Xiaoping's principle for foreign policy, which is keep your heads low and focus on your economic development at home. But anyway, if you look at what China has been doing in the last 3 years, that's not the case. So to a meaningful extent, we can say that anxiety about China's aggressive foreign policy conduct is not totally groundless. But whether China today poses an existential threat to the U.S., I don't think so, but certainly long-term, China can be a big problem for the United States in East Asia because China has the economic resources to build a very large and strong military that can can compete with the U.S. and that can threaten American allies. So that's this kind of worry I think we should have, but we have also to be very realistic and assess China's military threat to the U.S. in the context of a weakening economy, of a decaying political regime, and of enormous political, domestic political challenges facing the Chinese leadership.
Well, just in closing, since China's actions in the South China Sea seem to unite the neighbors against China as opposed to indicate any great success on their part, is this to do with this new leader? Is Xi Jinping I think he's sort of seems to want to be a throwback to Maoism, but is he the hardline communist reactionary nationalist that some people fear?
Well, I think the current leader clearly is more decisive, is willing to take greater risks, and embraces nationalism with greater fervor than his predecessors. He is also very successful in consolidating his power. And what he's going to do with his power, we now have some ideas. But if what is happening in the South China Sea is indicative of his future foreign policy, then everybody should be worried. The good news about China is that its leaders are not reckless gamblers like Putin. They actually know where to pull back. So we hope that this time they've tested American resolve, they've run into a huge war of opposition in the South China Sea, and they will beat a tactical retreat.
Well, Minxin Pei, I thank you very much. It's been a very interesting conversation.
It's a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Minxin Pei, who's a professor of government and the George R. Roberts Fellow and director of the Keck Center for International and Strategic Studies at Claremont McKenna College. We're going to take a brief station break and be back speaking with Florida Congressman Alan Grayson, who is running for Marco Rubio's vacated U.S. Senate seat. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Grayson, who represented Florida's 8th Congressional District in the U.S. Congress until 2011. He currently represents Florida's 9th District. As a congressman, Alan Grayson received significant attention for his strong stance on ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and holding politicians and bankers accountable. He authored the Grayson-Himes Pay for Performance Act, which placed limits on bonus pay to executives of banks that had received federal bailout money. And now, I take it, Congressman, you're running for the U.S. Senate in Florida.
So they say, yes. I'm running for the U.S. Senate in Florida. That's right. A state of over 19 million people. All of them have to learn something useful about me between now and November 8th next year.
Well, there's a couple of Floridians running at the moment in the presidential primaries. I'm sure you've noticed Jeb Bush and his protege, or former protege, I should say, since I don't believe they're on friendly terms, Marco Rubio. So it's his seat.
I'll tell you, I think that Bush has done permanent harm to himself, and people don't even realize the extent of that harm at this point. You know, everyone's obsessing over Donald Trump and his lead in the polls, but Bush has enough money to become the alternative to Trump during the campaign. What people don't realize is that although most Floridians have some positive feeling toward Bush, the fact that he said a couple of weeks ago and then repeated it again afterward that he wants to privatize Medicare is pretty much fatal in Florida. and Florida determines the outcome of the national election. So we may already have learned the outcome of next November's election just because he said something that Floridians despise and would never tolerate in any successful presidential candidate who wins Florida.
Well, he does seem to be an incredibly feckless candidate. I mean, it's surprising. For example, yesterday when the news that this reporter was shot dead on camera, he was asked a simple question and he couldn't answer it. He said, I don't have all the facts. I mean, what's wrong with this guy?
Well, I think people are trying to forget just how bad his brother was as president. And you know, we constantly say things like he wants to make sure that people can put food on their families. You know, it's one malapropism after another every single day that went on for 8 years. And I don't know why anybody would think that his brother is going to be necessarily an improvement over that. I mean, it is true that he was regarded as the smart one. But frankly, in that family, that's not saying too much. His father was the same way. I think it's hardwired into their Bush brains that they're going to say something stupid or not say something at all.
So let's look at the ledger then of your state. I mean, the governor is one of the, I think, wasn't he convicted and had to pay one of the biggest fines in U.S. history?
He wasn't convicted because he pled the Fifth roughly 75 times. I don't remember the exact number.
Right.
So he did manage to avoid being personally convicted, but he ran a company that paid the largest fine in the history of the United States in the Medicare program, over $1 billion. So the man who cheated seniors out of $1 billion, as well as the government and the taxpayers, has now been elected twice to the state that has more seniors than any other state. Go figure.
Well, but that surely you're the one who's got to figure this out, right? You're running for the Senate. What's wrong with the state? What's right with it and what's wrong with it?
Well, I think the one thing you have to understand is that there's enormous money power on the part of Republicans in Florida. We have state House races where the Republicans have 2/3 of the House of Representatives in Florida, and they nevertheless spend in individual races over $1 million to make sure that they get one or two more seats. When you're talking about state Senate races, there's 40 state senators. Easily, the Chamber of Commerce can put together $5 million for an individual race, sometimes more than that. The Democrats run these races penniless. The entire Democratic Party in Florida has a $4 million a year annual budget. And that's not even enough for one state Senate race when you're talking about what the Republicans do. So basically, the entire legislature is bought and paid for by the Chamber of Commerce in Florida. That's one element to it. Another element to it is that they've arranged so that all these state offices are elected in off-year elections. And Democratic turnout in off-year elections in Florida is typically quite poor. We've managed to change that in my own district because, among other things, I had over 70 canvassers knocking on people's doors in the midst of August and September and these difficult months in Florida when the temperature is often over 90 degrees. So we had decent turnout, and particularly we had great turnout among our Hispanics in my district, which is another tough nut to crack. But in general, Democrats in Florida don't know how to get out their vote in off-year elections, and I'm practically the only one who's made any gains in that regard at all, and only at the expense of spending $700,000 on our field program, probably more than any congressional candidate did in the entire country last year. It takes a lot of work and a lot of money, and we have the donor base to support that. I've got over 100,000 people who get to my campaign each cycle, but that makes me unusual. I personally have 4 times as many donors as the entire Florida Democratic Party.
Again, I'm speaking with Alan Grayson, who represented Florida's 8th Congressional District in the U.S. Congress until 2011. He currently represents Florida's 9th District, and he's now running for the United States Senate in Florida. And
by the way, running for Rubio's seat, you alluded to Marco Rubio earlier.
Yes.
He's running for president. He's vacating the seat. There's no incumbent in that position right now, and that's the seat that I'm looking for, to take that seat back for the Democrats and potentially take the whole Senate back for the Democrats. And I hope in a meaningful way. I mean, we don't just need more Democrats. We honestly, I'd say, need better Democrats. We have too many Democrats who are sucking up to Wall Street at every opportunity, including my opponent, in the primary. And, you know, the path to victory is to be a proud Democrat, you know, to explain to people what you stand for and more particular who you stand for. That's the big question in politics. So, I mean, Marco Rubio is leaving the seat, frankly, because he seems really bored by the Senate. He has the worst attendance record of any U.S. senator. There's 100 of them. He's 100 out of 100 in terms of attendance. And that was before he ran for the presidency. He basically felt that showing up was not part of the job. And seems to, you know, basically be able to escape responsibility for that. I've yet to hear any reporter ask him any question about why he missed more votes than any other senator. And it's a shame. I mean, we've now reached a point where the political system is so infantilized that all you need to do is be young and good-looking, and somehow your own personal mistakes are including things like showing up for work each day and actually accomplishing something are completely overlooked. In his 5 years in the Senate, he's passed nothing. I can't think of a single bill that Marco Rubio has passed that's become the law of the land. You know, in contrast, just the last 2 years alone, 15 Grayson bills are now the law of the land. And my party is in the minority. I can't force a vote on anything. And yet, nevertheless, there's 15 bills that I've passed just in the past 2 years alone. He's had 5 years, dude. He's passed nothing. You know, that is the job. It's not just getting on the radio and doing what I'm doing right now and talking about the issues. You actually have to do something about them. We're not picking the homecoming queen or the president of the senior class or something like that. You're picking the people who make our laws. And when you watch the presidential race, you realize that that basic fact seems to have eluded most of the media and perhaps even some of the voters.
Well, it's pretty clear that Rubio is sort of, what should I say, using political office as a stepping stone to the next one. Isn't he really running for vice president?
No, I think, I mean, it may turn out that way because of this feeling that you have to somehow balance the ticket, which is a hypothesis that's been tested over and over again without any real success. I mean, I'll tell you right now, in Florida, Rick Scott, who we were just discussing, picked an Hispanic as his lieutenant governor to be on the ticket with him, which is the same way that a presidential candidate picks a vice presidential candidate. I don't know of any votes that he won because he picked an Hispanic in a state with an enormous Hispanic population. I don't think it actually mattered. I don't know anybody who said, oh, my God, that was such a brilliant move. That's why he won re-election. Quite to the contrary, I don't think even one person in five, probably not even one person in 10 in Florida, can identify who the lieutenant governor actually is. I've seen no polling to indicate that balancing the ticket with Rubio or with anybody else actually would make a difference. I tend to think the opposite. But, you know, the empty-headed people who live inside the echo chamber called the Washington, D.C. media will immediately start blathering. As soon as Rubio drops out of the race, that he should be the vice presidential candidate for the Republicans because he will somehow hypnotize the voters into thinking that the Republicans are not really as anti-Hispanic as they actually are. Well, and you know, I'll tell you, I've got my district is almost 40% Hispanic, and I think I have pretty good insight into how different blocks of voters make up their decision. And I'll tell you that they can put five Hispanics on the ballot, and it's not going to make any difference because the Republican Party is awful on the issues that matter to Hispanics. 40% of the Hispanics in Florida have no health coverage. The number went down this year because of Obamacare, but it's still a very substantial number. And the fact that the Republicans consistently are opposed to anything that would actually allow Hispanics to go see a doctor when they're sick means far more to them than the fact that Marco Rubio's parents were born in Cuba.
Well, but with Donald Trump being so far ahead in the Republican primaries, and it's not inconceivable that he could become the nominee. I don't think Rubio has got a snowball's chance in hell of being his vice president. And let's face it, Trump has done lasting damage to the Republicans in terms of his ad hominem and incredibly nasty attacks on Hispanics in general, not to mention on foreigners. I mean, this is just pure traditional right-wing populist ideologue, isn't it, at play here?
Trump is actually saying what many Republicans think, but they don't have the nerve to say. And his nativism, his prejudice, his, you know, awful misuse of the facts. I think Donald Trump is the only person who thinks that people who cross the border caused the crisis in Ferguson, Missouri. To give you one example, that actually reflects the mindset of the 4% of the population that votes in Republican primaries. I mean, think about that. He's got 30% of 4%. 30% of 4%. Do the math. That shows that he's got the support of 1.2% of the American public right now. And that's enough to propel him far into the lead of the Republican primary. Who are these 1.2%? Is it safe to say that at least 1.2% thinks that they need a savior to save them from the brown people?
Well, how is this? I mean, why does the squeaky wheel get all the attention then? I mean, how could our politics be so distorted?
Well, the answer, I think, is that his opponents are incredibly boring. I mean, I listen to the Republican debate. I think that in general, not just Republicans, but many elected officials sound like mealy-mouthed fools. And Trump, with his bombast, manages to break through that and make the others seem, as the term you used earlier, feckless by comparison. And, you know, I understand that people are just so annoyed and put off by the drivel that passes for political discourse in this country, that they would end up in some significant number supporting a demagogue like Trump. I know where they're coming from, but what that shows, in essence, is the failure of our political system to generate meaningful alternatives. I'll give you an example. I'm proposing a platform that has a very direct, dramatic impact on the well-being of seniors. I've introduced a bill, a very popular bill, to extend Medicare to cover your eyes, your ears, and your teeth, since those are excluded under current coverage. It's called the Seniors Have Eyes, Ears, and Teeth Act, in case anybody's wondering about that. And introducing another bill to fix the broken cost of living adjustment that cost seniors $25 billion last year alone. And also another bill to eliminate the double taxation on Social Security. You pay into Social Security, you pay taxes, and Social Security pays out to you, and you pay taxes again. And that just, everybody understands that that's not fair, whether you're a Democrat or Republican. The political system is largely, and the media, are largely incapable of generating that as an actual choice for voters to have. And what we have is, in the end, a flaw, a fundamental deep flaw in the concept of representative democracy. In many respects, we'd be better off as a nation if you could put things like this on the ballot, but instead we choose people who put it on their own ballot called Congress, and we delegate the moral responsibility of governing to these people. These people in turn become captives of the system. I often remind people that there's 435 congressmen, and I am the only one of all of them, of all 435, who raises most of his campaign funds from small contributions. At our website, senatorwithguts.com, by the way, I have to say that. I'm the only one who does that at 435. Everyone else is a captive of lobbyists and PACs. They get most of their money to a man and to a woman from lobbyists and PACs, and I'm the only exception to that rule. So, of course, the political system generates drivel, because if it didn't, then people would have to vote against the interests of their PACs, their contributors, and of course that's not plausible. That would never happen.
Well, in terms of the parties, though, I mean, it seems, for example, that the Republican establishment is having heartburn over Trump. I'm sure he's just a complete nightmare for them. But then, the Democratic establishment, for example, they're not backing you, are they, in Florida? I mean, they're backing this your opponent, who up until very recently was a Republican.
Well, I mean, let's be clear about this. That there are two people in Washington, D.C. who are the self-appointed leaders of the DSCC. That's the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. They're not elected by Democrats. They're not even elected by members of Congress, Democratic or Republican. They are self-appointed, and these two individuals are saying that they're backing my opponent because, frankly, it's a payoff to Wall Street. you may have heard that Elizabeth Warren has caused Wall Street heartburn. My opponent has simply basically, on the Financial Services Banking Committee, handed over his voting card to Wall Street for the past 2+ years that he's been in office. And there was talk that Wall Street would boycott the Democratic Party unless they could bring Elizabeth Warren back in line, backing my opponent, who's got the fourth worst voting record out of 188 Democrats in the U.S. Congress for a promotion to the Senate, is their way of placating Wall Street and trying to deal with this problem that Elizabeth Warren and other populists have created. And I think it's a pity, but no, I wouldn't say that the Florida Democratic establishment is against me. I don't think that that's true. It's that these two people in what amounts to the D.C. Party Politburo are against me and trying to make it seem like my opponent would somehow be, electable himself. I mean, the fact is that not only is he an errand boy for Wall Street, but again, Social Security and Medicare are very important issues in Florida. And he said on CNN that he favors cuts across the board, and he specifically included the Medicare and Social Security programs. He's unelectable. You can't say things like that. You can't even think things like that and get elected statewide in Florida. And yet they're blind to that because they just want to basically give Wall Street what Wall Street wants.
Well, just in closing, you mentioned the 535 members of Congress, and at this point, President Obama and the country is facing the prospect that we'll have 535 secretaries of state if the Congress can override the president's expected veto of the P5 plus one deal with Iran. That strikes me as a deeply constitutional issue. Where do you stand on that?
I haven't decided how I'm going to vote, but I will tell you just as an observer of the process that the way that the process has been set up, it's almost impossible for the president to lose. You know, normally when we have an agreement between countries, it's a treaty. And under the Constitution, treaties have to be ratified by 2/3 of the Senate. In this case, we've taken that constitutionally mandated procedure and we've actually turned it on its head. And now all that has to happen for the deal to go through is that either 1/3 of the Senate or 1/3 of the House has to support the president. And for goodness sake, he's the president of the United States. It's incredibly unlikely that the president couldn't get 1/3 of the Senate or 1/3 of the House to go along with anything. So my own vote is still in play. I haven't decided. I see good arguments on both sides, actually, both for and against the agreement. But I would be stunned to see that the president couldn't see his veto sustained by either the House or the Senate.
Well, Congressman Grayson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having a great show that keeps people informed.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Alan Grayson, who represented Florida's 8th Congressional District in the U.S. Congress until 2011. He currently represents Florida's 9th District. And as a congressman, he received significant attention for his strong stance on ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and holding politicians and bankers accountable. He authored the Grayson-Himes Pay for Performance Act, which placed limits on bonuses paid to executives and banks that have received federal bailout money. And he's now running for Marco Rubio's U.S. Senate seat in Florida. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.